Clinical research on the role of the Oncotype DX assay has led to a major change in the treatment paradigm of patients with ER-positive, node-negative tumors, and a new assay, the so-called MammaPrint assay, has also now been introduced and is the subject of the so-called MINDEC trial. I met with Dr. Martine Picard, the principal investigator of this interesting trial, and she began our conversation by commenting on the background to the study.
A few years ago, we were really impressed by the work of our Dutch colleagues of Amsterdam. So these people were lucky because they had in the freezers of their hospital tumors coming from women with node-negative breast cancer that had not been treated with any adjuvant systemic therapy and had been followed for up to 8 years. And they had a unique opportunity to divide this population of women into a group of women with the development of early distant metastasis within the first 5 years following surgery, and another group which did not experience metastasis. They went on using the microarray technology to analyze these tumors, and they found a signature of 70 genes which very nicely separated these two groups. And what was really impressive at the time was that the performance of this signature was better than the performance of the traditional clinical and pathological factors that we are using in the clinic to estimate who is at risk of a distant relapse. I think at that time we got very enthusiastic with the idea that this was the beginning of a new era, but that a lot of additional work needed to be done if we really wanted this tool to become one day available for clinicians in their practice. So the first important step was the validation of this signature on a completely independent population. That took many efforts because it's not so obvious to find frozen tumor material from patients with node-negative breast cancer, a decent follow-up, and above all, women without any adjuvant treatment. So we finally managed to identify 300 tumors in 5 European cancer centers outside the Netherlands. And we conducted a very strict validation study with the tumors being sent to Amsterdam, but all the clinical data not being available to the Amsterdam people, but being sent to statistical office in Brussels. And we managed to validate the signature very nicely. It predicted outcome and it retained its prognostic value in a multivariate analysis. So after that, we were ready to go for a prospective validation in a clinical trial. And that is the beginning of the MINDEC trial, which took also some time and efforts in terms of finding the right design for the study. At the end of the day, MINDACT will have a design very close to TAILORx, which is a similar trial being run in this country, meaning that the 6,000 women who are going to be enrolled in the trial are going to be assessed both ways. So on one hand, with the 70 gene signature, on the other hand, with adjuvant online, which we think is one of the best available tools today to predict outcome of women with breast cancer. So if both tools indicate a high risk, these women will receive chemotherapy. If both tools indicate a low risk, they will not receive chemotherapy, but most of these women will be treated with adjuvant endocrine therapy. And it's the group in the middle, the discordant group, where when the two tools are not giving the same information. So this is the critical group where we are going to randomize to either trusting the adjuvant online program and ignoring the signature, or trusting the signature and completely ignoring the clinical and pathological factors that are integrated in adjuvant online. And essentially, we want to prove that the signature is going to be right. And what is interesting is that in these discordant cases, 80% of the time what's happening is that the signature tells you that the patient is low risk, while adjuvant online tells you it's a high risk.
How do you define high risk?
We had a long discussion on that, and we had to get a consensus among many, many European countries. So we ended up defining high risk as a probability of being free of any relapse at 10 years, of 92% for an ER-negative tumor, and 88% for ER-positive. And that's because, of course, for patients having ER-positive tumors, adjuvant endocrine treatment will be given and will, on average, lead to a 4% gain at 10 years.
So these patients will be randomized to chemotherapy or not?
Yes. At the end, it's exactly the same as what is happening in Telorix. It's just the way to describe the randomization. So we don't randomize for chemo versus no chemo, but for trusting a certain tool. But at the end of the day, it's going to be the same result. So about half of the women will receive chemo and the other half won't.
Now, this assay requires fresh tissue, correct?
Yeah, which is a big challenge.
Why is it that you decided to pursue this study and this assay in the face of the Oncotype that doesn't need to be done in fresh tissue and, to me, seems like has more data behind it?
You are right. I think in terms of extra validation, Oncotype DX is a little further down the road. But, you know, what we think is that in 10 years from now, we will have even better signatures than those ones. And by using the microarray technology, in fact, we are going to get information on the full genome for all these 6,000 women. So we are not only going to look at the 70 genes, but at the entire genome. And that represents a fabulous source in terms of translational research, because it's going to allow us to look at potentially different signatures that will be developed in the next 5 years, to look at signatures predicting organ site metastasis, for example. So we will be able to do many more things than just the study of the 70 genes.
Right now, is the assay being utilized in clinical practice?
No, not that I am aware of, and I hope it's not, because I strongly believe that this prospective validation is really essential.
How much of an impediment in the long term do you think the fresh tissue aspect of this is going to be?
That's a difficult question. I'm hoping that we will have technologies that do not require frozen material. But it's a question of education. You know, we conducted recently a trial in the EORTC, which also required fresh frozen tumor samples that were taken prior to neoadjuvant chemotherapy. And this was a trial that enrolled 1,800 women in 15 institutions, and it was not a problem. You know, after 1 or 2 months, everything was organized in these cancer centers, and there were no problems identified.
Am I correct in saying that the MammaPrint assay is actually available for use in the United States, I think, as of recently?
Yeah, it got FDA approval and it's commercially available.
But you don't think there's a role for it right now?
Well, I think the data are indeed quite interesting, and I suspect some oncologists may want to use it for some cases where they have doubts. Perhaps exactly like Oncotype DX is not used by everyone in the country, but perhaps for selected cases. You know, these cases where with the traditional factors, you are in the gray zone. It's impossible to tell if it's a good prognosis or bad prognosis. So I suspect the same thing will happen with the MammaPrint. I don't know about the cost of this test compared to the cost of Oncotype.
Do you yourself use the Oncotype assay? Are you able to use it in your practice?
Yes, I have done that 2 or 3 times, so not very often. But I remember an interesting case where the question that I was asked was whether a woman recently diagnosed with node-negative breast cancer could follow her husband to Vietnam for a mission there. She had breast cancer diagnosed recently, and there was the question whether chemotherapy should be given or not, and it was this kind of tumor where indeed you are not 100% sure. So it was a grade 2 tumor. Hormone receptors were expressed, were not terribly high. Progesterone receptor were low. And I ended up ordering the test. So the problem, of course, is that you have to send the block in California. But I got the result back and I was happy because it was a low recurrence score. And I could tell the woman that indeed tamoxifen was a good treatment, that she didn't need chemotherapy and she could indeed follow her husband and go to Vietnam.
One of the interesting things about the Oncotype is not only is it prognostic, but it seems to be predictive in terms of benefit from chemotherapy. Do we have that type of data for the MammaPrint assay?
We are collecting these data, but you know, all these signatures are going to be predictive because when you look, they are based on proliferation genes. And so it looks a little bit like we are reinventing the wheel because it's not so surprising that chemotherapy works better in those highly proliferative tumors as compared to the slow proliferating ones. Oncotype DX also quantifies ER in a very accurate way, and so it's not surprising that chemotherapy works better when ER levels are low. So I think this is going to be true for most of the signatures developed so far.
Let's talk a little bit about the next generation of trials looking at adjuvant therapy of patients with HER2-positive tumors. Can you summarize some of the things that have happened in terms of research reports in the last 6 months or a year you think that are most important for oncologists to be aware of? And I'm particularly interested in your take on the presentation of the BCRG-006 trial by Dennis Lehman at the last San Antonio meeting. Can you talk about sort of what your takeaway was from that presentation?
I must say that I came back from San Antonio last year very enthusiastic because at that time Dennis Lehman presented an analysis of treatment outcome according to co-amplification of TOPO2. And this looked really beautiful and so logical because at the end of the day, the tumors with co-amplification of the two genes seem to benefit significantly better from the anthracycline-based regimen, while this was not the case for the non-co-amplified tumors. And I was excited and I thought maybe this needs now to be validated by an independent team in a prospective way. So now in San Antonio, it turns out that with a little more follow-up, this is no longer true. So I was disappointed to hear that. On the other hand, I wonder if the message that is coming out of this is not that the type of chemotherapy you give is perhaps not very important. So if trastuzumab does 80% of the work, chemotherapy, of course, is less crucial. And so I'm starting to wonder if you need to give anything else than a taxane with trastuzumab or vinorelbine plus trastuzumab, if we really need to go for these quite aggressive regimens with the addition of platinum or the anthracyclines. Now, I would still be very cautious because I would not jump to the conclusion that anthracyclines are dead in the adjuvant treatment of breast cancer. I am confident that one day we will find out biomarkers indicating which are the patients who benefit from these drugs.
Now, one specific finding in that study was the issue of the non-anthracycline arm, the TCH arm, as opposed to the anthracycline arm with trastuzumab, the ACTH with the T being docetaxel in this situation. What did you come away from in terms of your impression of those two regimens?
Well, I think it was great that these investigators had this idea of putting a third arm in this trial, which is an original compared to all the other trials. So it's important for women because clearly now we have solid data on this regimen in HER2-positive breast cancer, meaning that we can certainly use it for selected women, women who have cardiac risk factors, for example, or also women where the risk of relapse is incredibly high and you do not want even to wait a few months before starting trastuzumab. Also, a big advantage of this regimen is that you do not run the risk that after 3 months of anthracycline-based therapy, there is a problem with the left ventricular ejection fraction and you have to tell the woman that she cannot access trastuzumab, which doesn't happen often, but is clearly something very, very bad, I think.
Right now, in your own practice, outside of a clinical trial setting, how are you approaching the use of trastuzumab, for example, in a node-positive patient in terms of the chemo that you're using?
Well, I think I'm asking myself two questions. The number one question is, am I worried about an early relapse? Yes or no? And the second question is, am I worried about the risk of cardiotoxicity? Yes or no? So the risk of an early relapse, we did an interesting analysis in the ERA study. We looked in the control arm, so women who did not receive trastuzumab, and we looked at the pattern of relapse in this group according to hormone receptor status and nodal status. What became apparent is that with 4 positive nodes or more, there is a very high risk of relapse in the first 2 years. To me, this indicates that these women are probably better served with a strategy that gives trastuzumab upfront. And we also discovered that women with hormone receptor negative tumors have a higher risk also to relapse early on as compared to those with hormone receptor positive tumors. So I'm using that also as a factor to decide whether I go for immediate trastuzumab or delayed trastuzumab. And then the cardiac risk factors. I know that this is still an area where we need to do a lot more work, but there are some early signals that have been provided by the analysis of cardiotoxicity in the NSABP study and in the HERA study. And it looks like age is a risk factor, hypertension is a risk factor, obesity might be a risk factor according to the HERA data. And a left ventricular ejection fraction in the lower range could also be a risk factor. So if I am in the presence of these risk factors, I'm also going to think twice about the use of anthracyclines and perhaps favor a regimen like TCH.
There are people who would say, after seeing those data, well, let's use TCH in everybody. It sounds like there are lots of patients that you're still going to use anthracyclines in. Why?
Well, because, you know, I don't think that you definitely change practice on the basis of one trial. That's number one. Number two, the curves of the anthracycline-based regimen in BCRG006 are the upper ones.
Where are we in terms of the next generation of clinical trials? And specifically, I'm interested in the trial that I guess was Aphrodite and now I understand is called ALTO. Can you talk about that trial?
It was a pity that we had to change
the
name.
I like that name.
The name was fabulous, but, you know, we discovered that it had been used by another trial, so we couldn't choose this name. We had to change. The ALTO trial is going to be, first of all, a unique experience in terms of collaboration because the HERA trial was already phenomenal in the sense that it was a trial where women across close to 40 countries participated, including women from South America, Australia, Europe. And now, with the ALTO trial, it's going to be a really global effort with the support of our American colleagues from the American Breast Cancer Intergroup. So that's in itself already a real challenge and a great venture. The second really interesting feature of this trial is that it will have a really extensive translational research component, something that I have always been dreaming of. We are going in this trial to collect the tumor blocks for all women in order to be able to prepare tissue microarray. We will collect blood on all the women for pharmacogenetics. We are going to get frozen material in selected centers, hopefully on about a quarter of the women. So it's a trial that will enroll 8,000 women, so we will get frozen material on about 2,000. And we will also save blood for future proteomic studies. And then what is really also, I think, an improvement is that we have already made some hypotheses as to which might be subsets that are going to derive perhaps a greater benefit from the introduction of lapatinib in the treatment scheme. And that is, I think, important and new. So an example is the c-MYC co-amplification, which has been studied by Soon Paik in the United States. So it looks like if you have HER2 and c-MYC co-amplification, you do extremely well on trastuzumab. So what we have postulated in the ALTO trial is that this is not the group where we are going to see an advantage from lapatinib. It's the contrary. It's in the group that does not show co-amplification that we are going to see an advantage. We have another hypothesis on P95, which is a truncated receptor lacking the external domain. And there are very good data, although preliminary data, suggesting that this happens in about 10% of women with HER2-positive breast cancer, and these women do not respond to trastuzumab for obvious reasons, but might respond to lapatinib. And then also I think that when you design a trial like that, which is going to involve so many women and is a massive effort around the world, I think it's very important that you pay a lot of attention to the design of the study, because there is not going to be a second chance for this drug. It's the only one. And that's why the design may look a little bit complex, but as I said, it's only this trial. There is not going to be another one. So we really wanted to investigate all the possibilities, which are lapatinib alone as an option. We think this could be an easier treatment in certain parts of the world. It could be a cheaper treatment. And the sequencing of the two agents and the combination. Now, why the sequencing? The combination everybody understands, because that is the maximum inhibition that you can achieve by attacking the receptors on both sides. And that should be the better arm, presumably. But the sequential strategy is important too in case the toxicities of the combination arm would be problematic. So it's another way to give the two drugs, but perhaps less toxic way at the end of the day. And so in the adjuvant treatment of breast cancer, everything relates to risk versus benefit. So we felt that it was important to have this additional arm in the trial.
And that's going to have trastuzumab first, then a little rest period, and then the lapatinib?
Yes, because first of all, there are more data on this type of sequencing. And also for practical reasons, we felt that for patients, it would be very difficult to do it the other way around, you know, to start with an oral drug and then after a few months to have to go back to the hospital to get an IV.
What's the actual regimen and how is the chemotherapy and these two agents put together in the protocol?
Well, again, you have to realize that this is a worldwide effort and there is no standard chemotherapy regimen accepted in the entire world. We also wanted to offer this trial to countries where taxanes are still problematic. So we are not requiring taxanes. But what we think is that the vast majority of women in this trial will receive anthracyclines and taxanes. So taxanes at the beginning of the trial are going to be limited to paclitaxel weekly, given concomitantly with the anti-HER2 treatment. The reason being essentially safety. We do have safety data for paclitaxel in combination with lapatinib, with trastuzumab, and with the combination. We do not have those data for docetaxel or Abraxane, but we are hoping that we will get these safety data. And if they look good, we will make an amendment. And these other taxanes will also be allowed in the trial.
So specifically, what kinds of chemotherapy regimens are going to be accepted and exactly when will the biologic agents be sequenced in?
So there are going to be essentially two strata in the trial. For physicians and patients who choose the combination strategy, it's simple. You will have to give first anthracycline-based chemotherapy, and that's going to be very open and flexible. It can be four cycles of doxorubicin cyclophosphamide. It can be three cycles of FEC, for example, followed by weekly paclitaxel combined with the anti-HER2 treatment. The second group is a group where physicians will be able to choose among a list of candidate regimens. They will have to give the chemotherapy as per the HERA philosophy. So the chemotherapy is given first, and then patients are randomized and go on to receive the biological therapy that is then not given in combination with any chemotherapy. And these regimens that you can give prior to the anti-HER2 treatment are many and include regimens with docetaxel. So you could give TAC, for example. You could choose to give three cycles of FEC and three cycles of docetaxel, which is a very popular regimen in France, and then randomize the patient into ALTO.
What's the eligibility of the study?
The eligibility is very close to the one of the previous trial. So it's for women up to the age of 70. It's also for women who have a tumor that is 1 centimeter or greater. So it's not a trial for the very small tumors. And of course, a difference in comparison with the previous adjuvant trastuzumab trials is that we are going to define HER2 positivity according to the new ASCO guidelines that were recently published.
And can you review what those are?
So there is a slight change because positivity means immunohistochemistry 3+. But you have to read carefully the paper because you now need 30% of cells stained to consider that the tumor is 3+. And it's a FISH positivity, but defined slightly differently from before. It has to be greater than 2.2, the ratio between the number of copies of the HER2 gene and the number of centromeres of the 17th chromosome.
So you're saying that the definition of 3+ IHC has been changed somewhat?
Yes, it has been changed.
And is that being implemented in the labs in terms of how they report?
Well, that should be the case. Yes, I think we need to inform our pathologist about this very important paper.
What was the bar before we're calling 3+?
It was 10%.
Huh. You mentioned the issue of patients with node-negative smaller tumors. How do you approach those people in a non-protocol setting, the patients with tumors, particularly that are less than a centimeter node-negative?
I think it's a nightmare. It's a big dilemma. I don't think that we have a clear answer, and we have really to struggle with the decision to give or not trastuzumab. So in my hospital, I think that we have finally decided to put a cutoff at 6 millimeters, so to ignore the possibility to give trastuzumab if the tumor is less than 6 millimeters, essentially. But when it is 6 millimeters or greater, and particularly if it's a negative tumor and a young woman, we offer trastuzumab.
What about the issue of trastuzumab without chemotherapy in the adjuvant setting? This has been brought up particularly in the older patient where maybe you don't want to use chemotherapy. Do you think that's a reasonable non-protocol strategy?
I think it needs to be investigated. You know, what would be really fascinating is to see if when you have co-amplification of c-MYC, you need chemotherapy. It could well be that in that situation, trastuzumab is all that you need. But we will need to test that in a clinical trial, I am afraid.
What are your thoughts about the effort that is about to be launched with the NSABP and the BCRG? The last I've heard, it's going to be TCH plus or minus bevacizumab, ? I'm not clear whether or not they're going to allow people also to put patients in who've had anthracyclines. But I think in terms of the BCRG and the NSABP, it sounds like it's going to be TCH plus or minus Bev. What do you think about that trial design?
I think there is a very strong rationale behind it. So I think it's going to be an interesting study. I wonder if these investigators could not take the occasion to see whether the platinum is really needed. They could re-randomize for this particular question because at the end of the day, this regimen might be totally unaffordable in many parts of the world. If it works, you know, you still need to be able to pay for it. So you will have two monoclonal antibodies. That's going to be very expensive. So why in that situation not try to gain with the chemotherapy, make the chemotherapy perhaps a little more affordable? So I don't know, that's a possibility.
I guess one of the things that's interesting about that study is the control arm is TCH, and they've just kind of made the leap over from anthracyclines. How do you think that people in practice are going to respond to this trial in terms of putting patients on it?
Well, it depends if you believe strongly in chemotherapy as being an important actor of the game or if you think it's the biological drugs. In fact, when you think 2 minutes, it's the only regimen that they can pick up because from what we have seen from the phase 2 data, there is a signal that there could be some increased cardiotoxicity there when you combine the two agents. So in the phase 2 trial presented by Mike Pegram, you know, there was a high antitumor activity, but there were a few cases of cardiotoxicity. So I think this could be an incredibly active combination, but it could have some problems in terms of toxicity. And there might also be toxicities that we don't know about today. So what is going to be critical there is to pick up cytotoxics that do not damage the heart. And so I think it's a very good choice to go for TCH, TCH plus bevacizumab. And then what is going to be crucially important is to randomize for the duration of therapy because of the cost. We unfortunately didn't do that in the adjuvant trastuzumab trials. And in retrospect, I think it's a mistake. I am really sad that I didn't think about this at the time we designed HERA.
This was a shorter duration.
Yeah, we were so excited with what we saw with the drug in metastatic disease, in particular these very long-lasting responses of patients that were kept on treatment, that we believed very strongly that we had to investigate a two-year arm. But in retrospect, I think we should have perhaps built a fourth arm in the study with 3 months treatment duration. So the two monoclonal antibodies, I think there must ideally be a randomization for a short treatment versus a somewhat longer treatment.
When do you think we might be seeing data from the 1 versus 2 years in HERA?
Well, that's an interesting question. We were hoping that this analysis would be mature in 2008. What we were told recently, because our independent data monitoring committee had a look at this arm at the end of 2006, we were told that there are less and less events, which is good news for women, and that the probability that we will get these results in 2008 is pretty small, and it looks more like it's going to be 2010.
So, but I guess the thing that I've heard people talk about the issue that you just mentioned, which is what about shorter durations, is if the 2 years is better than the 1 year, then you kind of don't need to worry about that. But it sounds like you have some concerns, and I guess the issue, too, is are you going to have enough events, even in 2010?
Yeah, well, we don't know that. And what we will have to discuss with the steering committee is that if we do not have enough events, we might amend the protocol and decide to present the results anyway when we will reach a certain amount of follow-up. Because the scientific community at one point needs to know what happened to this 2-year trastuzumab arm. We never saw any data, neither in terms of efficacy or toxicity from this arm.
Let's talk a little bit about adjuvant therapy for the patient with a HER2-negative tumor, both ER-positive and ER-negative, the triple negatives. First of all, how do you approach those patients in your own practice in terms of deciding about chemotherapy? Let's start with the triple negative adjuvant situation.
Well, I'm eagerly waiting for clinical trials there because I think that our knowledge of what is optimal chemotherapy for these women is currently very, very poor. What we know is that chemotherapy is incredibly important for these women. It's the only treatment modality that is helping them, apart perhaps from bevacizumab, which is clearly a potentially important drug for these women. So chemotherapy is very important, but as you know, there have been some reports suggesting that if you have a non-functional BRCA1 protein or a mutated BRCA1 protein, which can happen in this group, taxanes are not doing a good job there, and alkylating agents might be much better. Again, this is mainly based on some preclinical work, some, you know, occasional observations, but it indicates that we do not know what is optimal chemotherapy there, and it's urgent that we design studies for these women. So currently in practice, when I'm suspecting a BRCA1 mutation on the basis of the family history and I'm still waiting for the results of the genetic test, I tend to introduce alkylating agents in the treatment scheme. So for example, we have currently in my institution, we have a treatment scheme for these women because we are doing a pharmacogenomic study. And we treat them with anthracycline first, and then we used to give docetaxel full dose single agent. And I decided recently to change that and give them TC, which is docetaxel cyclophosphamide, just because of my fear that, you know, the taxane alone might be suboptimal. So I added an alkylating agent there.
That's fascinating. What were your thoughts about the TC regimen alone without Adriamycin or the anthracyclines that was reported by Steve Jones and the U.S. Oncology Group? What do you think about that study?
I've been watching this study for a long time because I found it intriguing and innovative and interesting. And I think it's great that this regimen is performing quite well, is better than AC, because, again, it's an interesting option that we can offer to women with contraindications to receive anthracycline, number one. I'm not convinced that this regimen is good for everybody because, you know, it's still the comparison between a taxane regimen and a suboptimal anthracycline regimen, which has been the problem of many taxane trials. If your control arm that is using anthracyclines is weak, it's easy to demonstrate superiority with your taxane arm. And that has been the criticism that we had for several of these taxane trials. And look at the recent results of MA21. So the Canadian trial makes the point that when you pick up as control arm a strong anthracycline-based regimen like the Canadian KEF regimen, AC followed by paclitaxel given every 3 weeks is inferior.
Can you go through exactly what that study looked at?
So the study had three arms. The Canadian KEF, which is a kind of golden standard regimen in Canada and is quite intensive in terms of delivering epirubicin on day 1 and 8 with oral cyclophosphamide, day 1 to day 14. The second arm was 4 cycles of AC followed by 4 cycles of paclitaxel, a regimen that is very popular in the US. And the third arm was dose-dense AC paclitaxel. And early results disclosed at the San Antonio meeting with, I think, a follow-up of 30 months median indicate that KEF is better than AC paclitaxel. Now, if you remember the story about AC paclitaxel, it was a regimen that was compared to AC originally. And it generated a lot of excitement. But in Europe, we were skeptical because we never use 4 cycles of AC. We use 6 cycles of FEC, we use the KEF regimen, the CAF regimen. And I think that we were right in a way because in this head-to-head comparison, the KEF regimen is better. Now, of course, we have to wait what's going to happen with the dose-dense. Is the dose-dense regimen going to be superior to KEF? I don't know. We have to wait. I'm not sure it's going to be better.
How are you approaching adjuvant therapy in the patient with the estrogen receptor positive, HER2 negative tumor?
Well, that's a group that is markedly heterogeneous. And if we refer to the gene expression profiling studies in breast cancer, there are at least two completely different diseases there called luminal A and luminal B. So the luminal A are not that difficult to diagnose in clinical practice. These are tumors where you see a very high hormone receptor content, both for estrogen receptors and progesterone receptors. These tumors are proliferating very slowly, so usually the Ki-67 is low and they are most often grade 1. And these are tumors for which I think chemotherapy brings very little, if anything. So even when these tumors have been neglected by the patient and the diagnosis is made late and there are 2 positive nodes, for example, I am not sure that you need to give chemotherapy. I think they are not chemotherapy responsive. On the other hand, I think for the luminal B tumors, it's a completely different story. These are tumors where you have a lot more proliferation ongoing. The endocrine responsiveness is not always evident when you look at the expression of the receptor. Sometimes they are not present in high concentrations. And there, I think chemotherapy brings something. It's just that we have not been doing the trials very in a smart way in the past because we have put all these patients all together. I more and more believe that we need to put the luminal A completely aside when we ask chemotherapy questions. They are just contaminating the group and making the results at the end very difficult to interpret.
What about hormonal therapy in the ER-positive patient? And particularly, I'm curious about your thoughts about the duration of hormonal therapy, particularly the aromatase inhibitors, and the long-term management of these patients over, you know, a 10 and 15-year period. Where do you think we're heading in that direction?
Well, I think that we became aware that ER-positive breast cancer is a very strange disease with continuous risk of relapse over time. That's bad news, I think, at the end of the day, because it could well be that this disease will be extremely difficult to cure. And if that's the case, we need to be thinking for really long-term endocrine therapies. Now, again, I'm hoping that with some pharmacogenomic tools, we will be able to identify patients at continuous risk of relapse from those who can be cured with a relatively short course of endocrine treatment. But for the majority, I think that this is not going to happen, and they are going to need a very prolonged endocrine manipulation. And there, we really don't know what is the optimal sequencing. We have currently very interesting data on tamoxifen first, followed by an AI, and that seems to be a very powerful strategy. Currently, in my practice, I try to go for 8 years. It's not based on anything very solid, but, you know, it's a compromise between the data of 5 years of tamoxifen and 5 years of an AI, and then 2-3 years of tamoxifen, 2-3 years of an AI. So I'm trying to do 2-3 years of TAM and 5 years of an AI. But I'm waiting with impatience the results of the big 198 study, because it has one arm with the opposite sequence, the AI given first and followed by tamoxifen. And I'm really curious what are going to be the results of this arm. They should be available in 2008.
The other arm also, the other sequencing arm in that trial, would also be available at that time. That's the TAM first and then the letrozole.
Yeah, so it's an incredibly interesting trial at the end of the day, because it's really making the head-to-head comparison from the beginning between an AI alone, the sequencing with TAM first, and the sequencing with the AI first. And that's really great.
So do you want to make a gentleman or gentlewoman bet with me about which of the four arms is going to turn out to be best?
I'm terribly bad at that. When I make predictions, I'm completely wrong most of the time. I really don't know. I am not sure that the AI alone will be a clear winner. But again, I tell you, I'm not very good at making predictions. But if there is going to be a difference between the AI alone and the sequencing arms, this difference is not going to be huge. And again, it's going to just tell us that on average, you are better off with your AI from the beginning, but it doesn't mean that this is the best treatment for each individual woman.
So right now, if you see a woman who's come to the 5-year point, who's had an AI for 5 years, are there situations where you'll continue it?
Yes, if the woman is at very high risk, many positive nodes, and if the tolerance is okay. So, of course, I will make a very careful evaluation of the status of bone, the lipids in the blood, and the quality of life in general.
Any other of the big studies that you might want to comment on?
Well, there are two very interesting big trials that are currently still recruiting patients. They are focusing on optimal endocrine therapy for young women. And they also represent huge effort of many investigators around the world. And I think these trials are going to be very important for these young women, because we have been over-treating young women with chemotherapy in the past. And in fact, the biology of the disease is what is really important. So again, in young women, there are tumors which are exquisitely sensitive to endocrine therapy and for which the addition of chemotherapy is probably not very beneficial. But if it's the endocrine therapy that matters, then, of course, we have an obligation to maximize the effectiveness of endocrine therapy. And that's why these trials are so important, because they are going to compare tamoxifen alone, tamoxifen plus an LHRH agonist, or an aromatase inhibitor plus an LHRH.
You're talking about the text and the soft trials.
Yeah.
And my understanding was that those trials were not accruing that well. Is that correct?
Well, one died. And it's
that was the third one.
The third one, the Perkid trial, right, which was incredibly interesting, I thought, but had to be stopped because of poor accrual. This was a trial where the question asked was, when you give optimal endocrine therapy, is there a need to give additional chemo? So the randomization was chemo versus nil, and that didn't work for reasons that I don't clearly understand.
That's always a tough randomization, though, you know?
Probably. So it would be interesting to see if the problem was with the patients, with the doctors, or both. But you may be right. Maybe it's a problem with women also.
What about the SOFT and the TEXT trial? How are they accruing?
They are recruiting pretty well. I think the one that is doing best is the TEXT, which is not so surprising.
Yeah. Any guesses about what you're going to see in that trial?
Well, I think the aromatase inhibitor will be superior.
That's AI with an LHRH agonist, of course.
I think it's going to be superior in terms of efficacy. The real question is in terms of side effects and tolerance and compliance. So again, the risk versus benefit is going to be key there.
Is that a strategy that you'll consider in a non-protocol setting, ovarian ablation or suppression plus an AI in the adjuvant setting?
To be honest, I should confess that yes, I have been doing that on rare occasions. It should not be recommended. There are no data. There are no good safety data. But, you know, from time to time for individual patients, you have to take some risks. And I have had two or three very young women with very bad disease, many positive nodes, where I have proposed that instead of the conservative tamoxifen-based therapy.
Do you think more about it in the HER2-positive situation?
Yes. In the HER2-positive situation, I also tend to be more aggressive with the endocrine component, and in young women propose ovarian ablation more systematically. Now, again, I don't know if I'm correct in doing so, because is it really important to maximize the endocrine therapy component when you know that it's HER2 which is really driving the tumor? Anyway, in the adjuvant setting, I think we tend to use the better therapies because we know it's in this situation that we have a chance for cure.